This is CliffCentral.com.
Right. There are so many questions and so many people with opinions running around at the moment. We talk about everything on this show, and you know that every day there's a new controversy going on in government. There are new players on the political playing field, and often it can get confusing. Sometimes you actually need to defer to people who know what they're talking about, and occasionally it's worth spending a bit of time with people who have already spent a bit of time checking out the facts. So Richard Callan's one of those people. I don't think we've met before, but I've been a massive fan of yours since the first book, and I've been reading a lot of this stuff in the new book. I haven't finished it yet because I'm just exhausted, and I think there's so much news going on at the moment that we're all a little bit fatigued. But really, Richard, congrats on the new book. Make or Break is what it's called, and thanks for coming to see us this morning.
Gareth, thank you very much indeed. It's great to privilege to be here, and it's good to see my old book, the 2006 Anatomy of South Africa. That was my first attempt to kind of help people understand the lay of the land politically.
And you were spot on. It would have been embarrassing if your whole book had proven to not turn out the way that it did. And you already predicted a few of the things that are going on right now in that book. So you're sort of an educated and informed Nostradamus rather than just someone who's throwing darts at a board and hoping they'll land.
Thank you. I've never been called that before. But yeah.
Well, use
and
it.
I must just say, Gareth, there is another book between this one and the new one,
yes,
which is The Zuma Years, 2013. Right. And I'm proud of that. It's a big, thick, fat thing. It's more of a reference book.
I couldn't bring it here. It was too heavy.
Presumably you keep your front door ajar during the day with it. It's a great doorstop.
I've used it occasionally to defend myself from burglars.
That's right. It's multi-dimensional, multi-purpose book, that thing. But it does have a chapter on the Guptas, or on the Zuptas, and it was relatively early days.
Prescient.
But I think it was very clear already then what was forming around Zuma.
Now, first of all, let's just talk about you for a second. Why the interest? I mean, clearly everyone's interested in all of this stuff, but why the interest sufficient to cause you to have to spend much of your time looking into the organs of government, the organs of state, the structure of the ANC, the personalities involved in that, the power play between them? This is all fascinating stuff, but to dedicate yourself full time to doing it, what's the real motivation here? Is it just something that that you can't tear yourself away from?
Yeah, interesting question. I mean, at times it's a bit like watching a car crash. You know, you sort of rubberneck it. Other times it's my job, and part of my living is made from selling my expertise about this. I talk to investors, to international analysts, and so on. And you know, I'm an optimist, Gareth. And I, even now, with all the stuff that's going on, I still retain a sense of optimism about this country, which we'll probably come back to. Although it's got quite hard in the last couple of years. What I always try and do with my thinking and writing is shed light. Mm. We've got a lot of heat out there, but I try and shed light. And I try and, I always imagine a reasonably well-informed, intelligent, curious person who wants to know more about politics but feels let down by the mainstream media. Mm. You know, and frankly, the media in this country, it sometimes looks good. It looks like a proper media, but it's not well resourced enough to dig beneath the surface. So often I feel people are frustrated. They'd like to know more. I mean, your reference earlier, I heard you talk about from the 2006 book, when I shed light on Mujinku Gumbi's role as the sort of key player behind Thabo Mbeki. Very few people knew that.
Right.
And I was privileged enough to have access and to get to know her and to get to know the system a bit and to then write about it.
You even drew an organogram, I remember.
Yeah, the power map.
How the presidency worked.
Yeah, the infamous power map. You know, the funny thing about that power map, Gareth, some people said to me, that's the most brilliant thing we've ever seen. It really helps us understand. Other people said it's the most confusing thing we've ever seen.
Did you ever try to draw one for the current situation? Because I think that would be so messy.
It would, you know what, you're absolutely right. I did start to try it, and it was such a mess. And the funny thing was, I ended up with a very simple diagram, which was Zuma, and then like a castle, a big moat around him. And when I was researching the 2013 Zuma Years book, at one point I bumped into one of his advisors in the presidency who said to me, Richard, we're really looking forward to your new book because we want to find out who the president listens to because he doesn't listen to us. Which was an extraordinary thing, wasn't it? You know, with Anatomy, the closer I got to Mbeki, the more I appreciated and respected the sincerity of the people around him. That we might not have always agreed with them. They made lots of mistakes.
Look, he also gathered mostly sycophants around him, and he did centralize power. And for a while, even in your book, you predicted that he wasn't going anywhere in a hurry because he had assembled around himself his own little moat of protectors. But that all came crashing down in Polokwane. And since then, we've got to give credit where it's due. In terms of just cynical politics, President Zuma has played his hand extraordinarily well. The big clanger, though, for him was December last year in Nenegate. What changed? Because the projections up to there are completely different to the projections after. Am I right?
Yeah, you're right. It's a game changer. In my book, I say that when Zuma loses power, we will be able to trace it back to 9/12, to Nenegate, because it was a colossal, grotesque misjudgment. He's a very bold man, Zuma. He's an arch exponent, as you suggest, at power play. He understands politics and power very well, masterful exploiting people and their weaknesses. But he overplayed his hand back in 9th of December. He was literally at that point trying to clear away a defiant finance minister. Zuma's approach is, I am in power, what I say goes, no one should stand
chief.
In my way.
He's the
exactly.
chief.
He has a very old-fashioned traditionalist approach to power, and his attitude is he just doesn't understand why anyone, whether it's the courts or his advisors or even the people, should stand
him.
In his way and defy him, and that's why he also is kind of amoral. He never thinks he's doing anything wrong,
because
which makes him dangerous.
He's in charge, so
well, that's right.
He's almost like that infallibility thing that the Pope used to think he had.
That's right. It's quasi-religious in a sense.
It is.
But we live in a democracy, and one of the reasons I remain optimistic, Gareth, is the strength of our institutions, whether it's Tuli Madden Saylor and the Public Protector, or the courts, the Constitutional Court, and civil society, and the ability of people to ask difficult questions.
All right. So where do we begin here? Let's start with the projections up to 9/12. Most of what you would have done your research in there, and most of what the country would have expected for the forthcoming few years. The president is according to the Constitution there until 2019. What were the projections before this miscalculation?
Well, I think at that point he was very much in control, and those who were opposed to him within the ANC were silent and weak. What 9/12 did was to put a real burning torch under their asses, if I can put it crudely, and it made them angry. Gwede Mantashe is a good example of this. You know, the night of 9/12, he was asked by the media, what does the ANC say about the decision to fire Nene? He said, we have no comment because we were not consulted, and he was furious, and he remains furious. So Zuma had created a massive enemy in the Secretary General of the ANC at that point, and ever since, Mantashe, despite what it looks like sometimes in public, has been trying to contain Zuma, his containment strategy, and ultimately it will be a removal strategy when the balance of power shifts sufficiently, and what one's trying to do always is work out where is that balance of power, how is it shifting?
Well, that's the complicated thing, and I don't know if anyone can see inside the ANC, because even the people inside the ANC can't see each other. It's like a fog. Sometimes things are just, you mentioned in your first book, a bumbling and chaotic mess where nobody really knows what could happen next. Is there any way to get a read on how that balance of power is currently structured?
Well, in the new book, I've got a sort of table of the 80 members of the National Executive Committee, and I heard Justice Malala, my old friend, early on the line to you, explaining rightly that the National Executive Committee remains the most powerful political organ in the country, because it's where real power resides, and it's the only organ that can remove Zuma. In a sense, Parliament can remove him, but only really if the National Executive Committee, the ANC, decides that they should. And in that table, I've got the 18 names, because the media rightly say that that's powerful and who's on it matters. So I actually looked at the 80, and I wanted people to look at those 80 people. Who exactly are they? And I've suggested by putting their names in bold that there are 29 of those 80 people who are actually not supporters of Zuma, who are already turned against him. I'm told by people I trust, there are two or three more. So let's take this to say 32. Unfortunately, 32 is still not 41. So you need a majority of people on that committee out of the 80 to turn against Zuma. But I think the sands are shifting almost by the hour at the moment. And don't be fooled by Zuma's fight back this week on Pravin Gordhan. This is the act, the bold, brave act of a man whose political future is really in the balance. He's on the ropes, but he's a fighter.
He's on that list.
Yes.
Aaron Motsoaledi, you've highlighted as being not in the Zuma camp.
That's right, because he is
one of the few cabinet ministers who...
Yeah.
And we're sure of that?
I'm reasonably sure. I think when push comes to shove, at the moment when it turns, he would act fast against Zuma because he's a decent man. He's what I call part of the moderate middle of the ANC.
Jeff Radebe?
Radebe is a cunning old fox who has survived. He's the only man who's been in every single cabinet since 1994.
Hmm.
The only man or woman, I should say. The only person. He is a born survivor. And he survives by doing nothing in office, so he never upsets people in his departments and ministries, and by remaining close to whoever is in power. So when he's
a minister in the presidency.
Well, he is, and he's powerful. And he is, for example, now chairing this ministerial committee set up to handle the crisis in tertiary education, the universities. So he gets jobs like that. He's a Mr. Fix-It in the presidency. But again, he is someone who will turn on a sixpence, Gareth, as soon as he smells change in the air.
What about people? There have been a lot of people who have been very outspoken lately. Jackson Tembu, Joel Netshitenzi.
Yes.
Derek Harnikom has spoken out quite a lot lately.
Yes.
These are Tito Mboweni.
Yes. These are all people who are either what I'd call Mbekiites from the old days, or they are decent, principled people on the whole in the center or center left of the ANC. And what they see with Zuma is a kleptomaniac project that is associated with the kind of nationalist tendency in the right wing of the ANC, and they're very worried by that.
Now there's one name, and we spoke glibly about her being robbed of 83,000 rand earlier by her own nephew, but Winnie Madikizela Mandela is still very much in the NEC. She's a very influential person symbolically. She's the kind of person who could turn 10 people in her wake.
Yeah,
on the NEC.
Interesting point, Gareth. I mean, she behind the scenes, I think, is still an important figure within the ANC, but doesn't play much of a role publicly. I think she also is a traditionalist. I think she is very disturbed at the direction of travel of the ANC, but she also probably is quite deferential to power and respects the fact that Zuma is, after all, still the president of the ANC. I think she would also be very concerned about the ANC Women's League. The ANC Women's League is probably, of all the bits and
talk
structures,
about captured.
Yeah, absolutely captured. Totally, for some reason, immersed in Zumaism, as it were, for reasons that are absolutely peculiar. And it's because, as ever with him, he manipulates situations so you get weak people who are pliable at the top of these bits of these structures.
Are the weak, pliable people the other people whose names are not highlighted? Are these people who are in the thrall of Zuma and whom he pays for?
Yeah, in some way or another.
Part of his network of patronage.
That's right. It may not be hard, hot cash, as it were, but it will be some kind of advancement or preferment that has enabled them to get where they are. I mean, the interesting thing, as you know, in the book, I pose six questions that will be answered over the next 3 years, which will give us a real sense of where we're headed in the next 30.
What are they?
Well, the first is, and I'm coming back to your question now, was the 3rd of August and the local government elections, which was a game changer. Yeah. Now, some people foolishly thought, well, after that, Zuma will be removed. That was never going to happen. But what happened on the 3rd of August was a shift in power, such and significantly substantial, that people in the ANC started saying, ooh, well, now what about me? So if you're number 248 on the ANC list that got into Parliament in 2014 with 62.5%, you can do the maths. And you can say, well, if we drop to 55% in 2019, I would need to be 180 on the list or something. Am I going to get that? You know, so people are not so blinkered that they can't start to look ahead and figure out, what does this mean for my own personal political future and the salary and everything else that goes with it? So Zuma's got that to contend with as well.
And the other questions?
Well, I mean, one of them tweeted yesterday, perhaps the biggest, is who will win out of Zuma and Pravin Gordhan in this grotesque, ridiculous power struggle at the center of government? And that question, in a sense, may well be answered in the next 24 hours or so.
You think?
Well, when he comes back from... the assumption, which is the right assumption, is that he has enabled Abrahams and the NPA to act in order to clear the pathway as a pretext for him then to reshuffle and to remove Pravin Gordhan. And it's 9/12 all over again. Presumably it will not be quite as crude as that, in the sense that the person that will be shuffled
in... He wouldn't want
to
make the same mistake twice.
Well, no, but he will try and do it again, because his game still is about capturing Treasury, or getting to the point where Treasury can no longer stand in the way of some of the stuff he wants to do. And that's really, it's as simple as that. Again, it's about power. Zuma's game is not ideology. It's not even really money as such. It's power.
Well, in many respects, it's also just staying out of jail.
That's right, Gareth. And, you know, that battle carries on. Until he's satisfied, he will never go to prison and will never face those charges. He will continue to try and hold on to power because he needs to, or thinks he needs to.
All right, so he gets back from Kenya. What does he do?
Well, he then,
the next 24 hours.
And this is where, back to our early conversation, he has to learn from what happened in December. Will he consult with the ANC leadership, as he should? The culture of the ANC is, if you make a big decision, wherever it is, you have to consult the other leaders in the ANC. You can't act alone. That is embedded in the ANC culture. And that's why he screwed up last December when he failed to do that and created enemies within the ANC, serious enemies. So does he have the brazen boldness to say, well, to hell with the ANC. I'm the president of the country. I have the power in the under the Constitution to fire ministers as I wish, and fire Pravin Gordhan at that point. That would be an extraordinarily brave roll of the dice. I've for a few months now said he wouldn't dare do that, because he would then provoke within the ANC a backlash. The question, a bigger question, is how does Cyril Ramaphosa respond? The deputy president of the ANC in the country. In other words, the one man with arguably enough power to stand up to Zuma. What will he do?
So far, he's been effete.
Well, I've gone from being sort of rude about him in recent times to by saying things like he is the man who never misses an opportunity to miss an opportunity. to yesterday, I found myself tweeting the next 36 hours will tell us whether Cyril Ramaphosa has managed to locate his lost balls.
So we should be watching him very closely.
We have to watch him, and will he act? You know, the highest echelon of politics is a naked, desperate. It's like climbing Everest. You need a friend of mine in London used to say, you need a third lung to survive at that political altitude. So Ramaphosa needs that third lung. He needs to be able to breathe at that altitude, take a deep breath.
All right, who would
and stand up to Zuma?
What's he got to gain? What's he got to lose, Cyril?
Well, Cyril's what he's got to lose is that he ultimately becomes seen as the man who stood by whilst huge amount of damage was done by his principal. And he will then always be tarnished by that. He will be tarnished as the man who was weak and not strong enough to stand up when he should have done, and who died on a lack of principle. If he stands up and resigns, for example, walks out, takes others with him, creates a palace coup,
yeah.
Then he will be remembered as the person who did finally locate his balls and stand up on a matter of principle.
But wouldn't the result of that be that the president then has an even more free hand to operate as an how he'd like?
You see, this is the gamble for the... This is the acute dilemma the ANC faces. Stand up to Zuma and risk a massively divisive, blood-curdling war, possibly dividing the ANC totally, with Zuma saying, all right then, you're trying to remove me. I am the ANC. Go. I am
L'état
the ANC.
C'est moi, huh?
Yeah, it just takes it off. And you saw Malema last week with his usual kind of mischievousness, mischief, saying, I'm here for you guys. And he always, you got to watch Malema.
What was that about? I got very confused by that. Yeah, strategically, what's
he's
happening
telling
there?
People.
He knows what's going on. You've got to watch Malema to understand the ANC. And he knows that there's the potential split now in the ANC. The ANC is in a very delicate place. And it is not impossible. This is a slightly far-fetched, but I'm not predicting it. But that Zuma simply says, I'm the ANC. And by the way, I've got KZN and I've got three or four other provinces. We are the ANC. To hell with the rest of you. If you don't want to play ball, if you don't accept my power, my authority, to hell with you, go. And Malema's saying, I'm here, guys, come with me, we'll create a new thing. You could, in the next year, have a major realignment of politics.
That would be fantastically interesting.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a good path that would lead to even more instability and more uncertainty, but it would be an incredibly unpredictable and an exciting move.
That's right. And, you know, it would be exciting, but sometimes you can have too much excitement in life. And is it good for the country?
The wheels still need to turn.
Yes.
Okay, so let's just go back to Cyril for a second. If Cyril did this, if Cyril stood up and said, right, I'm going to resign, or I'm completely against this, I'm going to publicly make myself the opposition within the ANC to what's going on, who goes with him? Does he have enough support?
I think there are good men and women in the cabinet who would also go with him at this point.
Would they then have to redesign cabinet? Would there be a dissolution of cabinet?
No. If let's say five or six or whatever resigned with Cyril, then Zuma would just find people to replace them. They would still be members of parliament, so they would be, you know, they're. It's not like ANC members of parliament walking out when you lose your salary and everything.
And what happens to Cyril if he does that? Where does he go after that?
Well, then he...
Isn't he going to the wilderness?
He repositions himself. He says, I'm the man who came in on the ticket in 2012, Mungang, with Zuma. And for 5 years or whatever, 4 years, I've been doing my best to run the government well, despite the stuff. The stuff now has gone too far. And the decision, if that's what it takes, or if Zuma says, I'm going to fire Pravin, I mean, I still actually don't think he will, because I don't think Zuma can risk this. He can't risk another 9/12. And he may well have take the view that the charges themselves sufficiently undermine Gordon that it weakens him.
And as Justice said, maybe Pravin will then feel so compromised that he will actually resign himself.
That I have always felt was part of Zuma's strategy this long nine months, a cold war, that actually Zuma's just chipping away at him, trying to belittle him, undermine him, humiliate him, and that he hopes that one day Pravin will just say, I can't take it anymore, and go. But Gordon understands his leadership role here, and one of the most amazing things about this year has been Pravin Gordon's willingness to stand up to power. That's why he has accumulated support across the country.
Well, with the president being one of the tent pegs, there is a vacuum of power everywhere else, right? Around him, there's a certain faction, but everywhere else there's a massive vacuum. And whoever steps into that vacuum will find themselves as a sort of conductor, a lightning rod, for all the opposition, in whatever form it takes, within the ANC and without, business and civil society and everything else.
That's exactly right, and it's Pravin Gordhan, not Cyril Ramaphosa,
so it's almost like buying your shares when the stock price is at its lowest.
I've never thought about it like that, but something like that. And Pravin has chosen the role. He took on the leadership role of being the front. He's like a train going through very harsh conditions in Siberia with snow and blizzard, and it's Pravin Gordhan who is at the front of that train. All the others are in comfy, warm little restaurant cars behind him. They're the ones. They're standing by him, but they're in comfort zone. It's Pravin Gordhan who's at the front of that train, taking all this crap and fronting it up. And he deserves a massive medal. And that's why he's got an extraordinary and unprecedented range of support, from business leaders through to the South African Communist
trade
Party,
unions.
Trade unions, yeah. People like me, NGOs, Section 27, all of these people are saying, whatever you think about the Treasury and whether it's neoliberal or any of those ideological fights, we need the Treasury strong and efficient and honest. And this man is defending it against capture.
Well, imagine the EFF, the most left-leaning of our parties, backing the finance minister, who, in ideological terms, you could call a socialist, but who's absolutely in the same camp as the capitalists. It's incredible.
Yes.
This kind of collaboration is just, you would never have predicted this.
That's right.
Okay, so there are going to be people with lots of questions. You can call us on 0861-555-189 if you want to talk to Richard. His new book is called Make or Break. The next 3 years will determine whether South Africa succeeds or fails in the long term. It's all of our futures, so don't pretend that you don't care about this stuff. You can be tired of hearing about it. You could be bored with the way that it sometimes seems to go in circles, but you can't tell me that this isn't interesting.
Yeah.
Huh?
I mean, when you talk about the impact that it's going to have over the next 3 decades, I mean, is that essentially what you're saying? That's how long it's going to take to undo the damage that has been inflicted by the current regime?
Well, maybe not necessarily. I mean, I do think our institutions and civil society could bounce back. But last night I was at the Troyville Hotel doing a book launch, talking, and a guy from SARS came up to me who'd been fired during the whole change there in recent years. And he said to me, when damage is done to an institution, it does take a while to repair it. You know, it's like when you've had a fire in your kitchen. You don't just fix it quickly. It's like a whole rebuild. So that's what we're facing here. And that's why damage to institutions matters. And it's amazing, I think, how politics has shifted in the last couple of years. And people around this country understand institutions matter now. Public protector.
Well, let's talk about her. I'm glad you brought her up. I hope I'm not interrupting your answer to Mabale. But Tuli Madonsela leaves office tomorrow, and a new public protector comes in. We don't know yet whether she might end up being the surprise that Mogoeng Mogoeng was when everybody thought he was firmly in the president's hold and grasp, or whether she'll be the kind of public protector who is pliant and who will do what Sean Abrahams seems to be able to do at the NPA and just report to the chief. So let's just leave her out of it for a moment. But Tuli Madonsela's contribution has been enormous, which is why people regale her everywhere she goes. The public protector is actually another boring office. It's like an ombudsman for government, effectively.
That's right.
Mostly administrative and dull. And she herself is a very officious, methodical, painstaking sort of bureaucrat. But she's done something in that office which has got everybody fired up.
Everyone knows who the public protector is and what it does. They know it's headed by this woman who's brave and who stands up to power. And that's the essence of that at that office, Ombud. It does a lot of boring things, but it also has the strength of character, both her and the institution, to stand up to Zuma and to other powerful people when it needs to do that. She's a big loss. She's far from perfect. She and Helen Zille share one thing in common, which is that they should not be allowed to operate their Twitter account alone without advisors. But that apart, Madam Saylor, it really is an extraordinary person. And she is going to go out with a bang tomorrow, by the way. It's in her character. Her interim report on state capture, I think we can, I think will be explosive.
What could she say in there that would get everybody talking?
Well, I think she'll join the dots and put together a kind of picture of what state capture means. You know, and state capture means different things to different people. I think she's going to describe it well. She's going to describe how individuals in business with business interests worked the system and embedded themselves in the system and created relationships. And back to your question about the next 30 years, you know, you can. It's like taking a big misturn in a route. You know, it's a fork in the road. You take the wrong turn, but sometimes it takes you. You've got to drive for a long way before we can do your U-turn. And that's kind of the fork in roads we face, I think.
Tell me about Tom Moyane and SARS at the moment, because there have been a couple of really interesting books released. The Rogue book, which was
Rogue Unit,
which was launched last week, for Knochenberg and Adrian Lequet,
yeah,
right. They've pretty much given us insight into how SARS works.
Absolutely.
For the first time. It's always been quite mysterious, but we knew that SARS were the kind of organization who had to account for themselves like accountants would. There's a credit column and a debit column, and everything was kept meticulously. We've also discovered that institution has been damaged. You just mentioned, you spoke to someone last night, that has been damaged. It's not as effective as it used to be. It always used to be the pride of government departments, because we all looked at SARS and said, well, if SARS can get it right, what the hell's wrong with every other department?
Institutions are made up of people.
Yeah.
And the quality
That's why I brought up Tom Moyane.
And the quality of people determines whether the institutional organization is effective or not. It's as simple as that. So when someone like Moyane comes in, and I was on your side of the table, as it were, last week in Cape Talk, pretending to be a radio show host for
a
week.
Well done. How did it go?
There were some scary moments, and it was exhausting, but I loved it. And I had Adrian Lequet on, one of the writers of Rogue Unit, and consequently, I had to read the book quickly. And it's a fascinating book. I wish it had been out when I wrote mine, because it gave some really interesting insights into what happened at SARS. And the core point was this. Everything changed when Moyane came in. Mm. And as the leader, he then set in motion a chain of events which has broken the institution down, weakened it. Good people left. He fired good people. That's what happens. You lose your good people, you're weaker. It's as simple as that.
What other organs of state should we be very worried about at the moment besides the obvious NPA?
Well, the one, I mean, the main one for the immediate term, short term, is Treasury. That's the one we've really got to watch, and that's why the Pravin Gordhan thing is so, so important. Aside from that, the criminal justice system has, in a way, I'm kind of pleased, if it wasn't for the fact that the Treasury and the economy is at stake, I'm kind of pleased that Abrahams is now on the hot seat. A lot of attention is on him now.
Well, let's imagine that this case does go to court, and they are forced to try and put a case together. Every expert says that it'll make a mockery of the NPA.
That's right. And I think Abrahams, the real question is here, is he smart enough to understand this? Does he understand that actually, if this is as bad a judgment as we think it is, that in the end, he will pay for that? It's his authority that is being abused. And he is responsible. He's accountable for that. And maybe yesterday during the parliamentary hearing, that penny began to drop with him, that actually the system in this country is strong enough that it fights back. And if you are messing with that system, it will bite back at some point. It may take a while, but it will bite back, and he will be held accountable for that. Does he want to be on that side of history, or does he want to recognize his responsibilities? And that's why it was interesting to hear him say, it was kind of retreat yesterday, and say, well, I can review this decision. And so now, you know, Pravin and others can approach him and he can review that decision. So there was a sort of a shimmer there.
What about the courts?
I believe, and this is, you know, as a professor of law, this is one of the things I look at closely, is how judges are appointed and how they perform. And I remain, it's our strongest asset as a country. And when I talk to investors who are comparing Russia and Turkey and Chile and South Africa, the thing we are way ahead of all of those countries is the quality of our rule of law. You know, and I quote a guy there who's a asset manager who said, I'm taking $300 million out of Russia, putting it in South Africa, because I know your corporate leaders will not be arrested. Zuma's rotten, but he's not going to start arresting your CEOs like Putin would do. So it's a great asset, our rule of law. And that's why Malema, there's a chapter there on judicial appointments, which sounds boring. But if your judges are so important, who they are and how they're appointed is really important. And Malema recognizes that. That's why he sits on that committee, the Judicial Service Commission, and the chapter's called Judicial Appointments Malema Style.
Yeah, he's a hard guy in that panel.
He's brutal.
Very tough questions, and he goes into character assassination if he has to. He becomes very personal, asks people about their business relationships.
He becomes very personal.
Yeah, and that's what
he's
we
devastating.
Need. Yes. In a judge, you need someone who can stand up to that kind of
thing. It's harsh. I've seen people break down in tears regularly on that commission. People are sometimes, I fear, not applying to positions because they're scared of the JSC. But I would rather have it that way than some weak thing where people are not tested. We want these people to be tested because when they're on the bench, they are put under great scrutiny and great pressure. We need them to be able to withstand it.
I remember in your organogram for the previous book, the Anatomy of South Africa book, you had a big circle for big business. And business's influence on things is sometimes overestimated and sometimes underestimated by people who are or aren't in the know. They're the big enemy to the left. They're the big, powerful influence that actually, in a kind of conspiracy theory way, controls everything. Which, of course, we know is not true. We can see the effects of that. But the other side says that business is hugely influential and that, of course, nothing will go wrong because big business won't let it. Both are fallacious.
I think business is another, back to 9/12. One of the things 9/12 did was to wake up in business a sense of, oh, we need to have a much bigger say on politics and we shouldn't be so shy. We've got a stake in this economy. We've got a stake in government and politics, and we shouldn't be shy in engaging. And that's why one of the good things that came out of 9/12 was a new conversation between business leaders and government on a number of issues. They created a fund for small business and jobs and stuff like that. And now I also see, I know of at least two major companies in this country are now investing in civil society. They're funding NGOs that sue government because they know that's so important. Now, 10 years ago when I was trying to raise money for those sorts of NGOs and worked in that sector, it was impossible to get business to touch that. It was too scary.
The most cowardly people.
Cowardly. But I am worried about the response to Sipho Phetyana. You know, Phetyana is one of those people we can look up to. And when people say there's no good leaders in the country or in the ANC, I say, well, look at Sipho Phetyana. Here is a guy of character and principle who's had the courage to say in recent weeks that Zuma must go. He's rotten. And I'm a bit worried that business is applauding him, but then sitting on its hands. Who else is the rest of you stand up and be counted? It's a bit like the metaphor of the train I said earlier. You know, Seppo Pichan is now in the front of that train, and all the others are saying, "Well done, old chap," but and sitting in the restaurant car.
Where does that cowardice come from? I mean, what do business have to lose? What's at stake if they were more vocal involved?
Great question. I don't know. I think they're fearful of saying the wrong thing. They're fearful of looking silly, maybe. And
sometimes just losing government business.
And they are worried that their government relations will be disturbed. But actually, that rarely happens because
The business community has for a long time been craven. They were craven under Thabo Mbeki. They very much wanted to be in his good graces. And for a gap between then, and correct me wherever I'm wrong here, but between the end of the Mbeki era and very recently, business were pussyfooting around government in fear and trepidation. Then suddenly, they found some kind of a spine, and people like Sipho Pityana have spoken out. There are other business leaders. In fact, a number of our banks' leaders prevailed against the president in December last year.
Right.
To their credit, they stood up to him and said, "There will be dire consequences if you appoint this idiot Des van Rooyen." And they stood up to him, and he listened. And from then, they've started to feel a little bit of strength seeping back into their bones.
No, that's absolutely right. But they need to follow through on that now and put their money where their mouth is. And they need to invest not just in those institutions and civil society organizations that we need to be effective to hold government to account, but they also need to invest in their own intelligence so that they understand government and politics better. Because they've been very lazy and they've said, "Oh, well, let's get an old Robin Islander on the board and then we're sorted."
There are some businesses that are completely unafraid. The Guptas are in business. These people are anything but craven. If anything, they're the Machiavellian.
They're brazen.
Machiavellians. They're the ones who are controlling a huge amount of not only what goes on in the presidency, but even individual ministers who they don't bother to talk to the president about. They instruct them directly. It's more than brazen.
It's another form of government relations. I think our earlier conversation was about businesses that play by the rules and are not bribing and not exerting undue influence. Although there are businesses that secretly donate to political parties, and they shouldn't do that in my view. Political donations should be completely transparent.
Julius Malema, when I asked him about that, said something interesting. He said that what happens is that these businesses that do want to donate to, say, the EFF or the DA are victimized by government and therefore don't want that stuff to be transparent. His argument is if we made it transparent, the only ones who would lose were the opposition party.
Well, the DA have always said that. I don't think that's right. I think that actually the market settles down. AngloGold Ashanti under Bobby Godsaw gave quite substantial money every year, a third to the ANC, a third to the DA, and then a third to smaller parties. And did that affect their business? Did that destroy their government relations? I don't think so. In fact, Godsaw had a very good meeting with the then Secretary General of the ANC, Chalema Motlanthe, where Motlanthe said, "Well, you know, we'd like you to have given just one more rand to us than the DA, because just to show respect for us as the biggest party, but otherwise we've got no real problem." I think he was quite surprised that they were giving any money to the ANC and not just giving it all to the DA.
But the Guptas.
Yes.
Yes, our favorite family.
I need to finish this thought.
Okay.
These three brothers, they're not South African. They came here, they saw an opportunity. To their credit, that's all business is. They saw a way of influencing things to their advantage. They also employed the president's son. They employed Ace Magashule's son. They've employed another few key individuals in the ANC or their own family members. So they've got a nice tight hold on influence, certainly not more than that if you're willing to read just the lines that are written and not between them. What kind of power do these Guptas have, and how much more powerful or less powerful are they than people think?
And let's not be mesmerized by them. They're not the only ones. They are an example of this, a particularly brazen one.
People like Jimmy Manye are always saying, well, you know, Johann Rupert has a similar kind, if not a larger kind of
influence. You know, every business wants influence with government. It's kind of what do you do with that influence, and how do you get to that point? And how many rules do you break? I mean, there's always been, this country has a long history of a tight relationship between a part of the business community and government, and the rules of the game have never really managed that very well. The Guptas, though, and people like them, have seen an opportunity with Zuma that was kind of unprecedented to really manipulate the guy. And of course, he gets something out of it and the people around him. But that has really, it's been a toxic force in our politics the last few years. And Tuli Madonsela's report, when it comes out tomorrow, the interim report, I think will shed big light on this. You know, the ANC have kind of outsourced the work to her. You remember they tried to do their own investigation earlier this year, part of the containment strategy of Gwede Mantashe, Secretary General of the ANC, and they just couldn't do it. People were scared within the ANC, basically. Mm. Didn't want to stand up to Zuma. So he said, okay, we can't do it, but we've referred them to the public protector, and then kind of she will do our job for us, which was very interesting.
It does show that the power shifts there as well.
Just to get back to the funding of political parties, because most of them are afraid to reveal who funds them. I mean, we as voters, would we be gobsmacked and absolutely horrified if we were to find out? Is that something we wouldn't be? Would we not be able to handle the truth? Why are they so cagey about that?
I think it would be gobsmacking. I think that if you went back, let's say, you know, the 20 years, whether it's 10 or 20 or 30, and you saw who had particularly had given money to the ruling party, to those in power, because that's where you really want to exert influence, I think we would be astonished at the range of people, from kind of individuals through to kind of crazy people like Gaddafi or the Taiwanese. You know, basically anyone who thinks that through secret donations they can exert influence will have done so over the last 20 years. That's the problem with the system. Of course, we don't know, and I'm speculating, but I do have a reasonable sense of it, and I do have evidence that Andrew Feinstein and others came up with, that, for example, British Aerospace had donated $10 million, which was their kind of standard line item for this, to the ANC in order to lubricate the arms deal. Remember that 15 years ago?
Yeah, and we thought that was a big deal, and now we're staring down the barrel of
the nuclear barrel
of a nuclear deal.
Exactly.
Okay, so the Russians and the Chinese.
Well, the Chinese is more political, and I think Becky started that road towards a strong relationship with the Chinese. He saw it as an important political and trading relationship, and people like Rob Davis, for ideological reasons, have pushed the China thing. Zuma, who doesn't care about ideology or global politics,
About anyone, Richard. Come on.
You know, a spook that I talked to the other day explained to me his view is that Zuma's just like the old Burras that ran the country before 94, in that it's entirely parochial. It's about, do I control power in my sphere of influence, my farm, my province, whatever, and to hell with the rest.
There's a new Bruderbund.
In a sense, that's right. And you know, they don't care about the geopolitics or foreign relations or the price of the rand or any of these considerations, which are part of the complex management of modern government. They're just, looking out from my shtup, do I have power where I need it? Do I have the power to live my life as I want to without being interfered with? That very parochial kind of thing, which is not the South Africa I know. I mean, South Africa has played such an important role under Mandela in the world. It's looked up to. And unfortunately, that reputation is fast evaporating.
Who are the people who could still bring to bear some influence and haven't? People who still carry, whether it's symbolic in the case of someone like Winnie, whether it's quasi-real in the form of Thabo Mbeki or Kgalema Motlanthe, these are former presidents. Mm. We know where they stand, but they're not saying it.
Yeah, I think this, there's been lots of moves in recent times. The most recent one that's relevant is this new initiative. It's not an organization, initiative called Save South Africa, you know, which is an interesting organization. It has one single purpose, the removal of the president.
That's treasonous.
But it's not, because they rely on two constitutional principles. One, accountability. They say this president is not accountable, and the constitution requires him to be held to account. Secondly, it's not regime change, because it's asking parliament, and through parliament the ANC majority in parliament, to remove the president. They elected the president. Remember, he's not directly elected.
We didn't choose him, the ANC did.
In parliament, and parliament voted Zuma in, therefore they have the power to remove him. And what Save South Africa is doing is saying, use that power to remove a rotten president who's gone rogue and who is defeating the principles of the constitution. And it has people like Trevor Manuel, Sipho Phetyana, Barbara Hogan, and others, and I think it is getting traction.
I read a tweet this morning. I couldn't go into it because there wasn't time, but something Jay Naidu said about how what's going on campus mirrors what's happening in society. Do you agree with that? What's your comment on students and just this general malaise?
Yeah, I was hoping you were going to ask me this question.
Sorry.
It's just too tough. And you know, I didn't, when I joined UCT a few years ago, I didn't think my job was going to be quite so exciting. It's you know, the last year or two has been hectic. And last week I had lectures to give to the constitutional law class, and both were interrupted, disrupted in different ways. And the first one, eventually towards the end of a lecture, a group of protesters noisily barged into the lecture and disrupted. It was a lecture on freedom of expression, ironically. And in the second one, 8 o'clock last Wednesday morning, one student protest leader very politely put his hand up after a few minutes and said, Prof, why are you giving this lecture when the university should be closed and when so many of my colleagues can't get here today? It's not fair. And by the way, I'm asking this question in order to disrupt your lecture.
Well, how civil.
And he did it so politely and with such dignity that actually we then had a conversation about it. And the guy happens to be, his name is Scumbuzo. I used the fact that I was on air that afternoon on Cape Talk and invited him onto my show. And we had a very reasoned, reasonable conversation. There are some thugs in the student movement. There are some people who want a scorched earth, who want to stop people from learning. There are also people who care about learning, want to make it fair for everybody, and who are reasoned and reasonable, and he's one of them. And I had him on, and it provoked a really interesting reaction from callers, many of whom were surprised to find here was someone so dignified and respectful. Others unfortunately phoned in and said, you know, he should have his legs broken. And you know, there's a violent streak in the society which really worries me. And my real fear, to back to your question about what's happening on the campuses, is that there'll be a mini Marikana or even a Marikana, that the police or security forces will overreact. Or that someone will die accidentally, but it will have the same impact. You know, and
Mbali was saying in the news this morning that there are attempted murder charges being brought against a student.
Mbali, I heard you say that. Yeah. It's extraordinarily painful, because I've been arguing in the law faculty at UCT that actually we shouldn't be scared of our students, you know, and we shouldn't be locking our offices when they come down. We should go in out and
a lot of academics are. These are not people who are prepared to be on the front.
Well,
and you find yourself on the front.
Yeah, you're right. And yeah, it's right. And a lot of my colleagues are like rabbits caught in the headlights, because they're not prepared for this and they didn't expect this. And our leaders and our managers at the universities are not trained and prepared for this. This is not what they expected to be doing. You know, Max Price is spending every day thinking about security. You know, he's not prepared for that. And I wouldn't want his job for $1 million.
I wouldn't want one of his students. This is a horrible thing to say, but the fact is that we are churning out this year substandard students as compared to last year, even if their results are commensurate and even if they've gone through the same process, because they haven't had the opportunity to learn that last year's or the previous year's students did. And next year's may be even more threatened in terms of how little time they actually get to do their work.
No, you're right. It is a crisis.
So who would employ these
poor children? It's a full crisis. Well, you know, it's right. I mean, one of the ideas at the moment at UCT, I can only speak about UCT, is that we all stop worrying about finishing the academic year and just concentrate on exams. On the basis we've done 80% of the teaching, that's enough. Now, you know, play that forward a few years and you can see an employer faced by a graduate saying, oh, I see you graduated in 20 whatever. Was that a year when you did 80% of the course or 70% or 60%? You know, what's this degree worth?
Right, back of the queue.
And that's the danger here for everybody. And it's a real problem. And of course, if you're my friend Anton Steenkamp, whose son, I've got a son at UCT doing politics, but his son is doing medicine. What if you've only done 80% of your course as a trainee doctor?
And
that's a different proposition altogether.
And the part I'm asking you to operate on is
exactly
the part you didn't do.
No, exactly. You can't be half trained as a doctor. You can get away as a philosopher, maybe.
My concern in this whole issue is, are we having constructive conversations around finding solutions? Because my experience to date has been, whenever people try to come up with solutions of how to fix the fees problem, the solutions get shut down. No, it won't work because of this. Oh, no, it won't work because of that. So then what's the alternative? That there is no solution, in which case we're screwed.
I think you're putting your finger on it, Mbali, in the sense that this is intractable, partly because the student leadership is so divided. They've got different agendas and they're impossible to negotiate with, actually. So even if you are committed to negotiation, as many of the universities are, it's impossible to do a deal.
And nobody has authority to make a decision because there isn't any leadership. At this stage, it's attention seeking less than leadership?
Yeah, good leadership is about recognizing that you can't win everything, and you have to compromise. You have to. And Vish Satgar, who's a guy I respect, who's an associate professor here at WITS, you know, he's made the point in recent weeks, the student leadership should recognize that they've had some big victories in the last year. What they need to do now is shift tactics so they don't kind of destroy so many things, which will be hard to put back together again. And that's a very important point. But it requires a maturity. I sound patronizing now, but it requires a maturity in the leadership of young people, which perhaps is not there.
I mean, these are kids at the end of the day. So are we expecting too much from them?
Well, young people can be capable of great leadership and brilliance, but you need discipline as well. And the problem is student movement is not disciplined in the sense of back in the old days, and you talk to struggle veterans who are furious about this. I mean, the fiercest critics of the student leadership comes from kind of struggle leaders from the 80s who say, for goodness sake, this should not be like this. And one of their complaints is there is a lack of discipline in the student leadership movement, which means that they can't lead well, they can't ensure that the protests are peaceful, they can't ensure that the negotiations are sensible and intelligent, and therefore you can't make progress.
Well, a lot of this is a societal problem. It's because a lot of these students, and even the ones who are joining in who aren't students, don't have anything back home to relate to discipline, to give them any structure. Very many of these students haven't been brought up properly. And that responsibility now falls on the university. And a university in South Africa shouldn't be raising adolescents. It should be teaching adults.
Yeah, we obviously need to set the right standards ourselves. But frankly, you know, locking ourselves behind our doors when the student protesters approach is not an answer either. And other parts of UCT have had a different approach. They've gone out, they've cooked meals, they've bribed together, they've had painful conversations. But in the end, this country, when I arrived here in 94, was very good at talking its way out of trouble. It would organize the conversations, but it did so in a disciplined, facilitated way, with a commitment to finding a solution. And that seems to be what's absent.
The students they're protesting in the wrong places.
Well, part of it should be against government, but government has deflected this. And one of the most interesting debates is whether this is deliberate and whether there's a kind of, you know, one must be always careful about conspiracy theories because they're rarely, rarely right. Cock-up is usually the reason, rather than conspiracy. But you know, is there an attempt here to deflect attention? Is this deliberate either from people in government and or people in the student leadership, movement leadership? There's no evidence of that as yet. And there's very little evidence of party political involvement, but there is some evidence of it, you know, EFF involvement, for example.
All right, Richard. Well, listen, be safe. Keep writing fantastic books as you have. You help the rest of us to comprehend and digest all this complicated stuff that's going on. There are so many different forces acting in different directions that it's sometimes hard to get a handle on what's really going on. But you said you're an optimist at the start of this, so for God's sake, leave us with something positive. All of this, is this just the growing pains of a real country and a real democracy?
Yeah, and we shouldn't overreact. The tendency is to overreact, but no, it's a balance between overreacting and what scandal fatigue. You know, we don't want to become so cynical that we don't care anymore, but nor should we overreact. We have to recognize that there's a balance. This country has fine qualities. It's got great people. It has great leaders. Not all of them are in the right places at the moment. Some need to be removed. But we have people like Thuli Madonsela, people like Sepo Pitiana who give us hope. And we have institutions and organizations and a vibrant business community. So, yes, I remain optimistic.
Thank you very much for coming to speak to us. The book is called Make or Break, Richard Calland, How the Next 3 Years Will Shape South Africa's Next 3 Decades.
Gareth, thank you very much. Very
pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
This is CliffCentral.com.